We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Mr. Chief Justice,
and may it please the court.
Our opinion next turns to the problem of what the judicial role should be.
But I'm also aware of you know, jokes that I do that I go, oh.
Comedians have their own set of informal rules about ownership of jokes. So these aren't laws, they're just norms of the community.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. If someone steals something from you, let's say your brand new flat screen TV, you'd probably go to the police. If they steal an idea from you, let's say an idea for a car that flies, you might go to court. But if you're a comedian and someone steals your best joke, the one that makes people laugh so hard they can't breathe, you might not go anywhere at all. This week on Life of the Law, who owns jokes? And why the law probably can help you if someone takes yours. Of course, this story starts with a joke about a boy who plays football and his dad who wants to see him win. Mary Adkins takes it from here.
And that man is still, every single game, that dad is right there. And he's in college getting better. He wins a Heisman Trophy. He ends up in the NFL. 5 years later, he ends up in the Super Bowl.
This is Carlos Mencia. You may know him from Mind of Mencia on Comedy Central back in 2008. He's pretty famous and pretty infamous. He's notorious in the comedy community for stealing jokes.
You know, if I'm doing a show at the Improv and Carlos Mencia walks in, I have no reason to believe that he would ever steal a joke from me or an idea from me. But if I saw him in the back of the room, that's going to be in my head the whole time I'm telling jokes.
This is Rory Scovel, a comic based in LA.
Because if he decided to steal the joke, he would probably just get to have the joke and do his next special, and it would premiere on, you know, whatever network, Comedy Central or wherever, or just Netflix or a DVD that he sells, and he would make money off of a joke that I thought of. And
there are many examples of this actually happening. Remember that joke we just heard?
He shows him how to throw the bomb, how to throw the out, how to throw the hook, how to throw the corner.
Mencia did that on stage in 2006. Now, here's Bill Cosby on stage in 1983.
Teach him all that. Tackle me. Bam! And then soon he's bigger and he's stronger and he can hit you and you don't want him to hit you anymore. You say, all right, son, turn him loose on high school. And he's running up and down the field. High school, touchdown.
Then that kid goes to college and that man is still, every single game, that dad is right there. And he's in college getting better. He wins a Heisman Trophy. He ends up in the NFL.
And 800,000 people in the stand. La, national TV, and he catches the ball. And the camera's on him and you're looking and he says, hi, Mom.
Got anything to say to the camera? I love you, Mom.
Hearing this, it may seem pretty obvious what's going on. Mencia is stealing Cosby's joke. But when comedian Mark Maron confronted Mencia in a 2010 interview, Mencia said he doesn't steal, at least not intentionally.
And I am a sponge, so to speak. You know, I do remember, like, I don't write stuff down. But I'm also aware of you know, jokes that I do that I go, oh. I don't know anybody specifically as much as I know that this
is out there.
Is not a, yeah.
If you're a comedian, it's part of your job to soak things in like a sponge. And everyone knows this. But where is the line between soaking something in like a sponge and straight up stealing?
Comedians have their own set of informal rules about ownership of jokes. So these aren't laws, they're just norms of the community.
Christopher Sprigman is a professor at NYU who focuses on copyright law. He says that in the world of comedy, people don't really use the law to prevent stealing. Instead, they self-police.
About who owns jokes and how you come to own a joke and how you can sell a joke and how close you can come to somebody else's joke. So these are informal rules of the community and they're enforced through community action.
The comedy community is small. People go to each other's shows all the time. So if someone sees a comic doing someone else's bit, they'll say something. Word gets around, and usually that's enough. But what about the Carlos Mencias of the comedy world? What happens when talking it out isn't an option because the comic who's stealing from you is much more well-known, or even just because he insists it isn't happening? Turns out, the law really doesn't have an answer. To understand how we got here, we need to head back in time.
Hey, Grant, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. So, will you tell me your favorite joke?
Let me see. I've got a bunch of favorites, but let me tell you this one. This is about Boudreaux.
This is my grandfather.
In South Louisiana.
When he was growing up in Louisiana in the 1940s, jokes were just kind of around. Boudreaux is a staple character.
Boudreaux, he loved to fish. He's always fishing. He's in his little pierrot one day out on the bayou there. He's fishing, and he looked down, and he is nearly out of bait. Man, he literally said, what am I going to do? I'm about out of bait. And he looked down there, and there come a snake swimming right along by his boat. And that snake's got a little frog in his mouth.
This is kind of a long joke, so I'll help my gramps out here. Boudreaux sees the snake with the frog in his mouth, and he thinks, perfect, I'll use the frog for bait. So he grabs the snake and takes the frog, but then he's afraid the snake might bite him because he didn't think ahead. Luckily, he has some moonshine on him. He dribbles some in the snake's mouth. The snake looks happy, falls back into the water, and then comes back a few minutes later.
That snake didn't come back. He got two frogs in his mouth. That's about it.
My Gramps didn't write that joke. He just knows it. Law professor Christopher Sprigman says the first stand-up comedians were coming out of the same tradition as my grandfather. They just knew a lot of jokes.
If you think about stand-up comedy back in the 1940s and 1950s, it was based around the joke slinger.
Their hair was done by sticking her finger in the wall plug.
Right, so the stand-up comic who grew out of the vaudeville style of one-liners, joke after joke after joke.
Sprigman says no one owned these one-liners exactly. Comedians took each other's jokes all the time. There was even a name for it.
They referred to it as the corn exchange. So they bought jokes, they traded jokes, they stole jokes.
The corn exchange wasn't anything formal. It was just a blanket term for all of it, including at least one instance of a comedian buying another's joke file after he died.
Think of Phyllis Diller, people like this who basically just told a whole bunch of jokes.
You know, the problem, these miniskirts, what in the world is happening with fashion? If skirts get any shorter, I'm going to have my legs fixed. They don't go all the way up.
Sprigman remembers going to the Smithsonian to research Phyllis Diller's joke file. He found tens of thousands of index cards with jokes scrawled on them. Some were original. Others, not so much.
She loved a comic called The Lockhorns, which was a comic about this couple that, you know, this married couple that was always at war with one another. And for years, she obsessively followed this comic strip, and she cut a lot of the panels out of the newspaper and pasted them onto index cards, and they end up in the joke file.
And then on stage, when she talked about her fictional husband, Fang.
Of course, you know, my husband, Fang, he won't come into the kitchen at all because he's afraid of rats. Now and then he comes in at noon because he knows they eat out.
So in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, a lot of comedians are doing this. But in the late 60s, things start to change in comedy, in part because they're changing everywhere in the U.S. Over the 19th and 20th centuries, copyright law has gradually expanded, adding more and more protections to creative works, from music to movies to books to computer software. More people are caring all around about owning their work, and laws are following suit. But one genre gets left behind, comedy. And according to Sprigman, it comes down to something pretty simple. Who can lobby?
These are individual proprietors. There are several thousand of them traveling around the national comedy circuit. And they operate at a very small scale, mm-hmm. right? So there's no powerful corporate player who owns enough of this business to actually lobby for changes to policy.
By the 80s, the transition is complete. The corn exchange is history.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become? Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Now, even without the law behind them, comedians care about protecting their work. One way to do this is to make your stuff more personal, harder to steal.
So think of Sarah Silverman, right? So she has a very detailed comic persona. She's, you know, this smart but kind of obtuse moral monster.
Guess what, Martin Luther King? I had a fucking dream too.
If someone takes that joke, the name Sarah Silverman, if you know anything about her, goes off in your head.
I dreamed that I was in my living room. It wasn't my living room, but...
Today, you can find scores of lawsuits among artists in other genres. Photographers, musicians, writers. But there are virtually no copyright lawsuits between rival comics. No one has even sued Carlos Mencia, although there is a South Park episode where Kanye West kills Mencia over a joke.
Copyright protects original expression, but it doesn't protect ideas. And so often, if you wanted to avoid the copyright on a joke, you could just retell the joke a little bit differently, preserve the same idea that animates the punchline, but just change the expression.
Sprigman says you can find some lawsuits by comedians against people who take their jokes and make t-shirts, but not against other comedians who take their jokes and make money. Ironically, money is a big reason for that.
Copyright law is very expensive to use, so copyrights enforced through federal court litigation, that's very expensive. It's typically not worth it for a comic to file suit over a stolen joke, even if it's a really good joke.
In this realm outside the law, the gray area is pretty significant. Here's Rory Scovel again.
It's something that we call in comedy parallel thought, that something can be, two comics can have this exact same joke, not having stolen the premise or the punchline from each other at all. There's just some jokes that are a conclusion that you could easily, you know, easily come to.
This gray area is one reason why even if comedians did want to organize and push to be covered under copyright law, you'd basically have to overhaul the whole thing.
You'd have to trim back the distinction between ideas and expression. You'd have to protect ideas much more than copyright law does now. You'd have to basically remake copyright in the image of comedians.
And Sprigman doesn't think that would be a good idea.
So there is a danger that if we propertize ideas or styles or trends, what we do is we basically impoverish the culture. We don't promote progress, which is what the Constitution says that copyright has to do. So I think, you know, remaking copyright law in the image of comedians would potentially do very little for comedians and potentially do a lot of harm to the rest of us.
Right. So for now, comedians are on their own, making us all laugh and keeping an eye on the back of the room.
This episode of Life of the Law was edited by Casey Miner, with sound direction and production by Caitlin Prest. Matthew Darr, Kyle Kaplan, and Todd McDonald composed our music. Life of the Law is a project of the Tide Center and is part of the Infinite Guest Network of podcasts from American Public Media. Take a minute to check out some of the other podcasts, such as You Must Remember This and Wits. Go to infiniteguest.org. Distribution of Life of the Law is also made possible by PRX, Public Radio Exchange. Life of the Law is funded by you, our listeners, and by the Open Society Foundations. For more on this story and others on the law in our lives, to subscribe to our podcast, or to make a donation to support production of future podcasts, visit lifeofthelaw.org. I'm Nancy Mullane.
Hi, I'm Amy Choi.
And I'm Rebecca Lair, and we are the Mashup Americans.
The Mashup Americans. Think of us as your guide to the hyphen America world we live in. Are you first-generation Korean-American married to a Colombian-Mexican-American and making beige babies? Us too.
Or do you speak three languages and eat Salvadoran pupusas at Shabbat? Is Spanglish your best language? That's me.
Spanglish is definitely your best language.
Yeah, it was kind of a problem in graduate school.
Don't worry about it. We're done with that. So we've got a new show here on the Awesome Infinite Guest Network. You can go search for Mashup Americans in your favorite podcast app and check it out. We've got a great story about the mashup life of Donald Trump.
Oh, and I just went to Margaret Cho's house to Netflix and chill. Kind of.
Oh, my God. Vamos, let's do this.
As we like to say, get to know yourself, America.